The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Welcome to The Pet Show with Jimmy Jelinek and Dennis Quaid.
Next up on The Pet Show, the latest in canine computing.
Yeah, these guys they've created this operating system. It's a computer for dogs. And they want to give you a computer for Peaches.
Oh, great.
It can train any dog.
I think really?
It's based on this, like, the modern animal training, which is based in operant conditioning. And it, like, gives the dog a reward. And the more it engages with the computer, the more it learns. It's absolutely incredible.
Right. Wow. Hey, I'm really interested in this because all you really have to do for a dog is really just get their attention. You know, if you have their focus. Like, I put my finger to my nose. That's the way I get Peaches. Like, that tells her, okay, it's time to start focusing because we're working. That's what that says. And so she gets her computer, and then it's like you get some focus, and they're trying to figure out what you want them to do.
Are you, like, your dogs are pretty well trained, though, aren't they?
I train Peaches myself, and I learned a lot, to tell you the truth, when I did A Dog's Purpose, and then A Dog's Purpose 2, which is called A Dog's Journey. Just working with the trainers on A Dog's Journey 2, she's kind of a natural. Some dogs are naturals, you know. It's because they want to please you, but every dog wants a job, and it's about getting them to focus first.
Now, she was almost cast in the movie, right?
Well, she was an extra. She was in the background getting walked, but she got cut out.
Anyway, we're going to try and get you this computer.
But she's in number 3.
Oh, she is? Fantastic.
Yeah,
she learned.
I've already got her trained to do the thing where she leaps, you know, to get the toy, like in A Dog's Purpose.
So. I can't wait to see that.
For the past 5 or so years, as the so-called Internet of Things has expanded to the point where everything in our lives seems to be intertwined and interconnected with technology and the web, engineers and entrepreneurs have set their sights on the animal world. This, coupled with a radical shift in the entire notion of pet ownership, from loyal beast to fully sentient animal companion and family member, has given rise to an entirely new segment aptly entitled Pet Tech. The basic idea, beyond having smart technology that empowers our pets to lead happier and healthier lives, is that our pets deserve the same type of enrichment and rewards as their human counterparts. With this notion in mind, Eric Itis, an engineer and entrepreneur heavily involved in the development of the first generation of smartphones, began to imagine a computer for dogs. Others had tried before him and largely failed. His radical breakthrough was in how he envisioned the user experience. Instead of creating something from a human perspective, he attempted to instead think like a dog and designed an operating system around its behavioral characteristics. From this, Pupod was born in 2015 and described as thus. Our first product is a software-driven puzzle game for dogs that gets harder as your dog gets smarter. Dogs earn food rewards from a Bluetooth-connected feeder when they interact with the Pupod Wobbler smart toy at the right time, and pet parents can control the game difficulty from the Pupod mobile app. Now, on the eve of shipping their version 2.0, which promises to be a quantum leap in canine computing, we caught up with Eric Itis to discuss Pupod, pet technology, and whether or not he considers himself to be the Steve Jobs of doggy computing. Can you give us a vision for what the future of pet technology is going to look like in the next decade?
If you want to roll forward like 10 years and then look backward, then you can start to look backwards and understand how some of these dots are going to connect to that point. The vision for 10 years from now is that a non-connected pet product is going to look as ridiculous in 10 years as a flip phone looks today compared to smartphones. In my, and I use that example specifically because the first part of my career was building the early smartphone category.
Right.
We were doing it at a time when there were analog phones and pagers, but we had this vision of this remote control in your pocket. It sounded like something from outer, you know, it sounded like something from
right.
things that you were going to be able to do with a smartphone. I remember being able to tell my dad that, oh, you'll be able to just walk out of a restaurant and have a car pick you up and, you know, you won't have to call a cab and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that sounded nuts. And now we all take it for granted. And that same quantum jump is going to happen over the next decade because there's a number of forces at play to drive that. The idea of giving your dog a piece of plastic to chew on is just not going to make any sense. You're going to want to give your pets and the animals in your life products that are designed to, they're basically computing products that are software, you know, at the core of a computer, it's a piece of hardware that that's function is defined by software. And so, you know, there's a number of companies that have tried to put a screen in front of an animal, and I'm just convinced that that's the wrong user interface, that we need to design devices, computing hardware for animals, because the animal's the user. And it goes back to my background in user-centric design. I mean, I've designed software for pregnant women to plan their maternity leave and for police officers to schedule their work and to use on shifts and for people to check out of a restaurant. I mean, there's all kinds of software that are designed for specific kinds of users.
Right.
And when your user is another species, you really have to deconstruct the assumptions you make about how the software and the hardware are going to work and get back to what would that dog, for example, design if a dog could be a hardware engineer or a software engineer. I mean, obviously they can't, but we have to do that work on their behalf.
So at the heart of this user experience is the reward mechanism, correct?
The logical thing is food or treats, because we know that that's a valuable reward for animals. But there are other rewards around smell that are potentially even more. There's rewards to use smell as a reward for taking the right action. But the main thing is that the user experience is intuitive. You've probably never heard anyone talk about designing an intuitive user experience for an animal in software.
No.
But that's the way that we are coming at this problem. And because if you download an app and it's not easy to use, you just delete the app and download something else. If your animal doesn't find the user experience intuitive, they just walk away and do something else. So, and if you're sitting there pointing at this thing, trying to get the animal to interact with the thing, they're really looking at you going, what do you want me to do to earn the reward? Because their whole life they've been trying to please a human in order to get a food reward, as opposed to go down an intuitive user experience path with a product that is giving them the food and they're earning it on their own. It's a very different paradigm. And so going back to kind of 10 years out, these devices will be, I mean, the obvious one is an olfactory apparatus where you can have, you know, positive, negative stimuli for detecting cancer, detecting low blood sugar in diabetics, even detecting COVID, detecting explosive, detecting fruit. I mean, all of these abilities are innate in dogs. They have the ability to detect these conditions, but they have terrible tools. All of that training has been done manually. And so it doesn't scale. So you can think of this wave of, particularly our perspective on this wave of using technology, is to democratize the tools. And there's all kinds of skills that they're capable of. And if we make the right product, we make a better product than what's out there, we believe that humans are going to want to give their animals something more interesting than a piece of plastic to chew on.
Is the impetus behind that there's been this shift in the concept of pet ownership in general, especially now that millennials have become 51% of pet owners, and the idea of the family pet as people are pet parents, the pet is part of the family versus the old concept where they just lived in the backyard.
That's just one of the trends. And to take that millennial trend even further, because of the economic situation, millennials are having to delay human childhood even longer. So pet children are a much more realistic and affordable way to satisfy that desire to have a family, a family unit, you know, with those kind of children-like responsibilities. That trend is going nowhere but up. But there are other trends around just how millennials are tied, and even Gen Xers, really everybody is tied to their smartphone and wanting your animal to be part of your digital life. That just doesn't really exist today.
Right, okay.
And the other trend is connected homes. I mean, if you go to work, their animal is at home a big chunk of the day unless it's a dog that goes to daycare. And so for the animal to be in a home, in a connected home, and be a participant in a connected home, that's another trend which is going to be obvious a decade from now.
Can we expect a cat computer anytime soon?
We'll definitely build products for cats too, and actually lots of different animals. There's kind of two answers. There's two sides two answers to that question. The first answer is a cat is a very different user than a dog. I mean, they're a completely different species. So in order to make the user experience for the cat, we need to design specifically for that user. We've talked to a number of cat behavior experts. There's a lot that focus on dogs, but there's a niche that focuses on cats, and they've given us some great insight. Now, with that said, our product so far, the one that we've taken to market in version one and even the version two product, is all based on opera conditioning and positive reinforcement. So any animal that can be clicker trained, for example, you know, opera conditioning is the foundation under clicker training, can pick up the product. So we've had folks with cats, pigs, horses, chickens, all kinds of different species.
With your operating system and philosophy, I feel like you guys are setting yourselves up to be the Apple of pet products. Could you be the next canine Steve Jobs?
If you look back at some of the early movies about how Apple started in the garage, it really was building a computer in a world where people use typewriters.
Right.
And I think that the pet industry is in the typewriter phase. The leaps from, you know, a typewriter to a computer were like, well, you can do word processing on a typewriter or you can write a document on a computer. And it looks like a really expensive thing to write a document on. Why not just use a typewriter?
Yeah.
So if the mindset is just looking at the physical item and going, hey, this physical item makes a few more beeps and makes a few more, you know, it's an incremental user experience from the non-computerized item, the impact that data and machine learning is going to have on these products changing the digital services and the way that people feel connected to their pet, whether it's having their pet be happier or having their pet be healthier or just feeling better as a human because you're taking care of this family member in different ways that is fun. And it is, you know, we get dopamine hits from, you know, things like somebody commenting on our stuff on social media. And we also get those dopamine hits when your animal comes up and nuzzles with you. And you feel like, you know, there's this family member that just has unconditional love. And quite frankly, I think the reason why people buy these current pet products, you know, this might resonate with your angle on, you know, entrepreneurs. You know, as a startup, you always are being asked by investors, what problem are you solving? If I said to you, like, do you have a pet?
I have a cat.
and what was the last product you bought for your cat?
I'm staring at a cat hammock that I can't figure out how to install the straps onto the chair legs.
Perfect. A cat hammock. Now, what problem does that cat hammock solve?
Nothing.
No, it does.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is peel back the layers of that onion. What problem does that cat hammock solve?
Some place for the cat to bask in the sun that's not on my bathroom counter.
Go back to at the moment when you bought that hammock. Did you buy it online or in a store?
I bought it in a store.
In a store. And what were you thinking when you bought that product? That my cat needed someplace to bask in the sun? What were you thinking?
This would make him happy and that he'd like me more if I got him something.
Exactly. And so the problem that people are solving by buying these no-tech products isn't the problem that the product solves in the real world.
So smart. You want your pet to love you.
Yes, because they give you unconditional love. And as humans, we feel the need to reciprocate, to buy gifts for people, and to buy gifts for this family member that gives us nothing but love. So the challenge for pet product entrepreneurs is that if investors are looking to invest in your company, and your answer to why somebody needs to invest in a cat hammock is so that a cat has a place to lay in the sun, it's a pretty unconvincing reason. And even the reason of, well, I need to give back love to this animal is an unconvincing reason to invest in like a venture scale
product. Right, right.
So it's more about the opportunity. And if you see the opportunity as a white space, that and getting investors to be able to see there's a white space that people are going to want to buy these products and these digital services that don't exist today, it's kind of the white space that Steve Jobs had to paint.
Well, consider our minds blown. There you have it, folks, the future of pet technology. Thank you, Eric Heidis.
Losing a pet, it's never easy, is it, Jimmy?
No.
When they pass on, it can be traumatic for the entire family. There's also the question of what to do with them. Do you bury them in the backyard? What? Cremation? Taxidermy? Well, how about a stuffed animal clone? That's right, a stuffed animal clone. Next up on the Pet Show, we look at the booming pet bereavement industry.
Have you buried any pets in the backyards of your various homes?
No, I have, for the last 40 years, had them cremated, and I have them in little boxes, and one of those, like, clay that you can bake, you know, they put their footprint in.
Yeah.
They make an impression of their footprint, and all my dogs, I have them all on the mantle.
You have all five, your pantheon of great dogs that you told me.
Yeah.
You have all five of them, all ashes on the mantle? Wow.
Yeah, they were all great dogs. They're all right. It's beautiful. I think I myself would like to be cremated, except now I'm changing my mind about that. What I really think I'd want to do is I want to get cryogenically frozen like Walt Disney.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, you can do that, and it's a certain charge. I think it's something like $250,000 for your whole body, and they'll just do your head, freeze your head for like 50 grand.
We've spoken quite a bit here about the profound shift that's occurred in the notion of pet ownership and how that's impacted all aspects of the pet industry, from food and nutrition to style and apparel and technology. Finally, though, we've come to the end of the marketing funnel, so to speak. How do we treat our pets when they've died if we've treated them like family while they were alive? As you can imagine, the market for death care and pet loss is massive, to the tune of $28 billion annually. Based on the current pet population, an average lifespan of 11 and a half years for dogs and 15 years for cats, there are more than 11 million pet cats and dogs passing every year in the United States. Some choose burial, and there are over 750 pet cemeteries in the United States. The first dates back to 1896 and is located in Hartsdale, New York. The oldest known pet burial is a 14,000-year-old grave in Bonn, Germany, that contains the remains of two humans and a domesticated dog. And we know well that ancient Egyptians often took their pets with them to the afterlife. Many, though, turn to cremation, choosing to stay with their beloved in perpetuity, their ashes stored in elaborate urns and other keepsake memorials. Some choose taxidermy, and there's a whole market for folks who mount and stuff their pets. But the idea of that makes many squirm. Into this growing market and appetite for pet remembrance comes Cuddle Clones, a Louisville-based company that for $250 will make you a custom plush stuffed version of your pet and ship it to you in 6 to 8 weeks. There's even a custom pouch attached to hold their ashes. The way it works is you upload a series of photos of your pet from every possible dimension, and add any unique characteristic, scars or coloring or hairstyle, and a designer creates a scale model.
business is brisk. Cuddle Clones was named Louisville's fastest growing company by Inc. 5000 last year. We recently caught up with company co-founder Adam Green to tell us about this growing segment in pet remembrance and some of the stranger requests that pet parents have made. Let's check it out.
Adam, welcome to the Pet Show. Can you walk us through how this works?
Yeah, so it's all online. You would go to cuddleclones.com, and that's cuddle like you would cuddle with a blanket. Clone is in the scientific clone. Just some people hear that and they're like, what was that again? So cuddleclones.com, you would upload a number of pictures. We need at least a face picture, but we recommend, you know, both side profile pictures, back, tail, stomach, chest. Then you can write in distinguishing characteristics, you know, freehand. So he had a scar here, or please lay him in this position, you know, anything else that you wanted to add customly. We take all that information that goes to a designer. They design your cuddle clone 100% by hand, and it's unique to you. So we're not pulling, you know, one of three designs that are pre-existing and just modifying them. They're all 100% unique to your pet. And then it takes roughly 6 to 8 weeks with our queue to get it back to you. And part of that is finding the exact right fabrics that we think will match the fur as best as possible. And then the designing process itself. Now, you can get it a lot sooner than that. That kind of pushes it to the front of the line. But the typical turnaround is 6 to 8 weeks. And then it's just mailed directly to your house. So we are completely vertically integrated. We take the order on the website. We manage that. We manage the production. And we fulfill it and ship it out of Louisville here in Kentucky.
Say I've got a big dog like a Great Dane. Can I get it made to size?
Yeah, we get that question a lot, and the answer is no, you cannot. A lot of the clones actually are to size on the smaller breeds, just out of the nature of the size of the animal. But your bigger breeds, Great Dane, even the, you know, medium to larger size dogs like Labs, they're not going to be to size. Now they are, or to scale, I should say. Now they are relative to the breed size. So if you order a Chihuahua and a Great Dane cuddle clone, those cuddle clones are going to be much different in size, but the Great Dane's not going to be a true Great Dane size. It's going to be roughly half of what a real Great Dane would be.
As you can imagine, pet owners can be peculiar with their requests. None more so than bulldog owners, apparently, whose desire for anatomical accuracy when it comes to genitalia can borderline on the obsessive.
So apparently bulldog owners are very fond of accurately capturing the testicles if their aren't neutered, which we do not include that on the default. So, you know, that's not something we would typically do. So it's only when asked and only if it, you know, makes sense and we can do it with the design and whatnot. But that has happened enough times that it's somewhat of a trend, and enough times that I can say for some reason bulldog owners are at the top end of that request.
What material makes for a great replica bulldog testicles?
Yeah, it's the same material we really use for the rest of the plush. It's just to get the tautness, I guess I'll say, so it's not really soft, is to pack the stuffing a little bit tighter. So, and that's even outside of the testicle part, that most of our cuddle clones are a bit more firm than what a stuffed animal you would buy at like Walmart. Like, they're not floppy, they are to form.
Beyond getting a stuffed replica of their pet, how else are your customers able to modify their orders for bereavement?
We offer a zipper pouch. It's kind of like discreetly put in like the lower belly of the plush. And we created that for people to put in ashes if they've cremated their pet. Cause a lot of people just don't want an urn, but they're gonna have this custom stuffed animal anyway. So kind of knock out two birds with one stone if you were gonna have the ashes anyway. And we found that a lot of people will put like photographs or other, or even fur of the animal that they have left over, or anything else that I guess is special to them in this pouch too. So that kind of gets also to the point of, I guess, when they, a lot of times when they have special requests, we say, hey, well, you know, we have this zipper pouch.
The desire to memorialize one's dog doesn't just apply to those who have passed. A good majority of their orders come from those who simply love their pets and want something that broadcasts their affinity for their fur babies. Celebrities have started to take notice as well, says Green, who has shipped cuddle clones to Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Ellen, and Demi Lovato. But at the end of the day, the desire to keep hold of that bond we shared with our pets by creating something permanent seems to be the overriding impulse of a majority of Cuddle Clone's customers, and that will have to suffice until the possibility of actually cloning one's pet becomes a practicality. Until then, we'll take the plushie.
Okay, oh boy, not sure about this next segment. Jimmy, am I reading this correctly? The Definitive Guide to Animal Flatulence?
Yep. We're going to talk to Nick Caruso, who wrote Does It Fart? The Definitive Guide to Animal Flatulence. Let me ask you a question. Is Peaches a farter?
Peaches is an SBD, silent but deadly farter. And we just took a 1,000-mile trip from Los Angeles up to here to Montana. And every time we crossed the border, she would seem to really want to express that gas.
I love dog farts. They make that sound. It's like someone letting air out of a balloon or something.
Yeah, it's like it's already entered your nose and it's halfway down your throat when you realize it's too late. It's like you bit down on the cyanide pill and you're in it now.
Now, you've been around horses.
Well, they're really great to blame. They're really great to blame on.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Oh, Peaches. Oh.
What's the most hellacious animal fart you've ever encountered? Dog, horse, octopus?
That's really a good one. Lion farts are really bad. Cat farts are really... Stank.
Yeah.
It's some stank.
Yeah.
Like, sounds like a chino. I mean, it's just... Yeah.
In this next segment, we look at the science of animal flatulence and talk with Nicholas Caruso, author of Does It Fart? A Field Guide to Animal Flatulence. The book is a masterwork of field biology and observational science that began, innocently enough, when his co-author's brother asked, "Do snakes fart?" In her quest to uncover the truth, she reached out to a noted herpetologist, along with posing the question to all of science Twitter, where she included the hashtag, Does It Fart? Well, in fact, yes. Snakes do fart, often thunderously. The information was noted in an Excel document with facts of about 20 other flatulent species. Soon enough, it became a book, and a movement was born. Let's check in now to see which animal species break wind the best, and find out, does it fart? We reached out to author Nicholas Caruso at Virginia Tech University, where he works as a postdoctoral researcher, studying mainly the science of salamanders. Nicholas, welcome to the Pet Show. Before we begin, I think we need to assess, or at least discuss, what actually counts as a fart within the context of animals.
We first, you know, just said, okay, so where does fart come from? So the medical definition of flatus is gas produced during digestion that's expelled out of the anus. And we needed to broaden that a little bit because what we would consider a fart isn't necessarily digestive gases. Sometimes it's air that we swallow. And then also there's a lot of animals that don't have an anus. Some have where they expel gases. So, you know, amphibians that I study, they have what's called a cloaca, which is a structure that used for both reproduction and elimination of waste. So we needed to broaden the definition. So we decided that fart was basically any gas expelled out of any orifice that's opposite of the mouth.
In your book, though, you mentioned that sloths actually fart from their mouths. So how do you account for that?
Sloths are mammals. So right away, you'd think, oh, all other mammals, that, for the most part, fart. And so it probably does too, right? It eats a leafy diet, which generally leads to a lot of gas because of how long it takes to digest that material. It also has a very slow digestion. It's like something like every 3 weeks or something that they poop. It's ridiculous. So you'd think like all that time and difficult material to digest, you're like, oh, this thing must fart all the time. But for a lot of animals, and us included, like buildup of gas is a dangerous thing. This is especially seen in rabbits, where they can have their intestines rupture because of how much gas is built up. And so sloths actually resorb that gas through their bloodstream and they just breathe it out. So it's,
wow.
Again, and like if we're going by our definition, because it isn't, it's the mouth, so it's not opposite the mouth. It's not quite a fart, but it is.
That odor that would emanate from your posterior is now coming out your mouth.
Yeah, so that they, if you stuck a, you know, a methane camera or something in a sloth, and you would actually see like methane being emitted that it normally would be producing out its out its rear end, out its mouth.
The most fascinating one is the herring. Like they, mm-hmm. they seem to have incorporated farting into how they communicate, right?
Yeah, this was the scientist who discovered that. You know, that's a pretty infamous paper and discovery. Essentially what happened was they had them in these containers and, you know, if you're, I forget exactly what they're studying. They weren't studying communication, but they had these herring together. And, you know, when we do experiments, we try to simulate natural day night cycles. And so the lights went out and all of a sudden they kind of heard this weird clicking noise basically. And so essentially what they're doing is expelling gas out their anal ducts and creating this noise that allows them to find each other and stay close to each other when they can't otherwise see each other, so especially at night.
And it's like sonar? It's like fart sonar?
Yeah, basically. And so there's always, for you know, these smaller fish, there's safety in number. That's their way of being able to communicate, and those larger fish can't hear it. It's out of their auditory range.
Let's listen now to some live readings from Does It Fart in this lightning round of science-based flatulence.
Since they are popular pets, observations of python farts are numerous, and their flatulence has been described charmingly as thick and meaty. Though this release of gas may go unnoticed initially, as it is often inaudible, the subsequent and powerful accompanying stench due to the python's carnivorous diet is readily detected.
As rhinos are much bigger than horses, they produce a lot more gas. When in the African bush, in close proximity to rhinos, it is not uncommon to hear them emit numerous, long, loud farts while they graze. Rhino farts apparently also smell really bad, so much so that they have given rise to a piece of brewing terminology. When the yeast used to make alcohol through fermentation produces hydrogen sulfide, it gives off a horrible sulfur smell, known colloquially as a rhino fart.
Despite the high number of goldfish living in people's homes, and this was a bummer to learn, observing them pass gas is a rare occurrence. Although these fish do have gas-producing bacteria in their gut, it is far more common to see them burp out gas than pass it through their anal duct. So burping, but no farting, perhaps.
Does It Fart goes on to explore dozens of animal species and their flatulent behavior, and even begins to wonder, did dinosaurs fart? And megalodons? Did they fart as well? Nick Caruso provides the answers.
And so thinking about other sharks, where we do have evidence of them farting, you know, we can kind of make the assumption based on similar anatomy that they did also fart. As for dinosaurs, you know, the dinosaurs from which birds evolved likely had fairly similar anatomy and in especially their digestive anatomy. So we know that birds don't fart for a whole host of reasons, one of which is their digestion is very fast. And they also don't quite have the same bacteria that and gut flora that produce gas. And so from those animals, we can kind of make the assumption, those dinosaurs, that they probably didn't fart. But the larger sauropod dinosaurs most likely did based on similar anatomy to some of the modern day large herbivores.
So you mean like a T-Rex or something like that? T-Rex would have farted then.
So T-Rex wouldn't have farted.
Oh, because they're more descendant of birds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Likely wouldn't have farted. I mean, there's other things to be that they would have done that are pretty cool, but farting
is not one of them.
Thank you, Nick Caruso. Does It Fart? The Definitive Guide to Animal Flatulence by Nick Caruso and Danny Rabbiati is on sale now from Hachette Books and is a New York Times bestseller. Make sure to check out their other books, True or Poo and Believe It or Snot, The Definitive Guide to Earth's Slimy Creatures. And remember, he who smelt it, dealt it. And that includes your dog.
My cows fart, my cows burp, the world is in for a world of hurt. We can't last with bad gas, the temperature is rising real, real fast. Everybody knows what goes in must come out.
Next up, a segment we like to call Unusual Pets.
That's right. We're going to talk with a real-life skunk whisperer. She rescues and adopts skunks as pets. We talked about this earlier.
Yes.
She removes the spray glands, and then she raises them like cats and dogs. It's pretty incredible.
Wow. Skunks are very smart.
Are they? I didn't know
that. Yeah, well, look at Pepe Le Pew. He's one of the smarter cartoon characters we have.
He is. You know, if we go by Looney Tunes in terms of the hierarchy of animal intelligence, I would put Pepe Le Pew up there. Definitely above Sylvester.
Pepe Le Pew and Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
Ducks are obviously not very smart.
Yeah.
And neither are humans.
And Roadrunner, very smart.
Roadrunner is very smart. Coyotes never learn.
No, very stupid.
Okay, here we go.
Let's travel now to North Ridgeville, Ohio, and meet 62-year-old Deborah Cipriani, who runs Skunk Haven, America's only rescue center and institute for domestic skunks. Cipriani, who by day works as a customer service associate in the trucking industry, has since the year 2000 dedicated her life to caring for and advancing the understanding of skunks as animal companions. Now, before you hold your nose in horror at the prospect of living with one of Mother Nature's more malodorous creatures, pet skunks have their spray glands removed in a minimally invasive procedure which involves snipping of their spray ducts, which are hidden in the animal's anal cavity. While by no means pervasive, skunk ownership in the United States continues to grow. Cipriani also runs Skunk Fest, a yearly festival and competition that attracts thousands of visitors who come to commune with their fellow owners and compete for best in show in the annual skunk pageant. We caught up with Cipriani amidst planning for an upcoming virtual Skunk Fest, mandated because of the pandemic. She's a fierce and voluble advocate for what she believes to be a most misunderstood animal.
And believe it or not, skunks, probably wild skunks, are the most feared animal around, because most people may see a bear and go running towards it to take pictures. If people see a skunk, a wild skunk, they start running away from the skunk.
For people who want to keep skunks as pets, what can they expect when they bring one home?
Skunks are like people. There's all types of people. They're cute when they're babies, just like baby humans, but as they grow up, their personalities may change. So some are cuddly and nice, and some skunks don't want to have anything to do with you. Some skunks will like you and not the next person in your family. Skunks may or may not go in a litter box. To own a pet skunk, do not expect something that how do I want to say this? To own a pet skunk, just don't expect what you want. You have to give up your life for your pet skunk and change your ways. Don't expect the skunk to change their ways.
Much of Cipriani's work involves helping other skunk owners manage their own animals. She's on call 24 hours a day for all manner of skunk emergencies. Here she describes a typical skunk 911.
I may get a call at midnight saying, help. My skunk is laying there, and what do I do? My questions is, how old, when was the last time fed, get a syringe with some syrup in it and put it on the side of the mouth. you know, depending on the age, or it could be help my skunk prolapse, which is the intestines come out. And then I walk them through how to put it back in. And then I ask different questions like, have you wormed your skunk? And, you know, what's the diet and stuff like that. So it's a various, a lot of different calls. Or if an older skunk, help, my skunk can't walk. Again, I go back to diet. How much calcium have you fed? Have you had x-rays? Send me the x-rays so I can look at them. So it's a wide variety of phone calls that we get.
If you've been listening so far and think, hey, I want a skunk, be advised, these things are not cheap.
The breeders sell skunks anywhere from $350 to $900.
That much? Wow.
Yeah, different places, you know, sell them at different costs. There's a place in New Jersey who sells the skunks that are already neutered and spayed. So those, and they come with a whole kit with the taurine and the calcium. Now, New Jersey, their vets are extremely expensive to neuter, to be neutered and spayed. Their cost in New Jersey is anywhere from $600 to $800 to get them neutered and spayed.
To wow, where, expensive hobby. That's incredible.
Yes, it's very expensive. To where in different parts of other legal states, they may run to get them neutered or spayed anywhere from $150 to $300.
Wow.
So the cost to have owning a skunk can be very costly. I mean, I just, for example, I had one that had a tumor, a rescue that had come in and he had a tumor. I spent $1,000 to have that removed. And he actually passed on within a couple of days, the complication of the surgery.
For those seeking something beyond the traditional black and white coloration, skunk breeders have created a diverse array of options.
Skunks are, they're not just black and white anymore. And it was in 1961 that one of the breeders had an albino skunk. And because of that one albino, fast forward to where we are now, we have all these array of different colors, such as apricot color, champagne, beautiful gray skunks, beautiful shades of brown, and dark-eyed whites, which would be black eyes and a white skunk. So they're all different colors and all different patterns. So they're just not black and white, and they're beautiful.
Skunk ownership, warns Cipriani, is a full-time job rather than a cute hobby. And potential skunk owners need to be ready to organize their lives around their skunks.
If you take on a skunk, you have to be aware of the surroundings of the skunk. It could get out. You have to maintain the proper diet. You have to watch out for if you step on it, they get underneath the feet. You have to make sure you have a veterinarian ready to care for the skunk. And you got to be ready if it goes in a litter box, or if it doesn't go in a litter box, you have to adjust your lifestyle. And you can't go on vacation either, because you can't bring a skunk in an illegal state. If you get caught, it would get euthanized. But we try to warn people beforehand, before they get a skunk, what they may or may not get. It can be the perfect pet for you, or then it could be just the opposite.
And how do they mix with other pets? How do they get along with dogs and cats?
Skunks and other pets, you got to be careful that the dog is not going to jump on the skunk and break its back. You got to be careful, of course, watching any animal you introduce into your family. Don't expect that they're going to get along, but if they do, then it's perfect. So you always got to monitor. If you're bringing a baby skunk into your life and you have this big dog, the dog might try to play with it and break its back.
Oh, okay. And how many skunks do you have at the moment in your home?
I have many skunks. I have many different species of skunks. I do have a hognose. I do have a spotted. And I do have stripes. And I do have a zorilla, which is an African skunk. And I have many, many skunks. I'll just leave it as that.
No problem. And are they sort of free range in your home, or do they have to stay in the cage?
To own a skunk, you should not cage it. So most of them have free roam unless they have medical issues. Like I have ones that came in that have cancer, terminal cancer. So you have to confine those ones to make sure they're not going to get hurt by, you know, by anything. I've got ones that came in that can't walk. So, you know, if they're in a contained area, there is a reason, but most of them run free.
And do they like to sleep in the bed? Because I like my cat in the bed. Like, will the skunks come in bed and stuff?
Skunks do go to bed with you. Some of them do. Some skunks go to bed, sleep in bed with you. Some skunks sleep with me. It all depends on the animal. And you just got to be careful because, unfortunately, again, people who are not used to sleeping with animals may roll over and kill it.
Oh.
But I do have skunks that sleep with me, yes.
Oh, that's great. And where do they curl up on the pillow?
On my stomach.
Cipriani's work with skunks is a testament to the human-animal bond. One of her more recent rescues was the result of a tragic car accident that killed the driver, but the skunk passenger survived. She tells the story for the first time today on The Pet Show.
Several years ago, I got a message saying that somebody needed help. So I hurried up and called the phone number, not knowing anything, to offer Skunk Haven services. And I didn't know who I was talking to, but I was offering services. And they said, well, the skunk has to go to a certain state. It has to get out of the state. I'm like, okay. So I found a home for it in the state that they wanted to go to. And then 2 weeks later, the lady called me back and she goes, Deb, the state won't allow the skunk to come in. Like, okay. So I offered my permits and everything. What had happened was the lady's daughter was coming home from school in December, right before Christmas. She lived in an illegal state in Colorado. Her daughter went off the cliff and the car rolled. Her daughter died on impact.
Oh my gosh.
The cops came, you know, the state troopers came, they went down the hill and they, you know, they found the car, it was all smashed and they looked in the car and, you know, they just looked around and all of a sudden they missed something. They missed the carrier that was in the car. In the carrier was the skunk.
Oh my gosh.
The skunk was still alive.
Oh my gosh.
And because they lost their daughter, the state had a heart and not euthanized the skunk. That skunk is in my care now.
Deborah Cipriani has dedicated her life to the rescue and advocacy for skunks as pets. While the work is hard and often thankless, Skunk Haven stands as a refuge for this most misunderstood creature. We'll talk to you later.
Hey, make sure and tune in this coming Thursday for the Pet Show interview with Tyler Henry, star of Hollywood Medium on E!
The Pet Show is produced by Audio Up and is written and hosted by me, Jimmy Jalinek, and Dennis Quaid. Executive producers are Jared Gushtot and David Hurwitz and Dennis Quaid. Our editor is Bill Markt and our story producer is Emma Rapold. Have a great week. We'll talk to you later.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.